Okay, so we're back with another episode of Twirlies, Gypsies, and Ponies. And I'm Sasha.
I'm Sophia.
And since we no longer have an intro episode up, we feel compelled to introduce ourselves. Each episode is about what?
Well, each episode is about our main theme, which would be the chorus line, vaudeville days and burlesque dancers, and the shenanigans and the malarkey they had to put up with, and how they're relevant then and groundbreaking, how they're relevant today.
For those of you who are new, welcome. For those of you who have been listening to us, we're open to feedback. We did get some really helpful feedback about, how our Key City steampunk episode should have been our first episode instead of sort of like the focus that we did on Bessie Smith. And we will eventually get all of these episodes that we refer to up on a different program as soon as we find money, because everybody needs that. So this episode, we wanted to talk about strikes.
Yes, all about the strikes, why they just did the strikes, how it is relevant to then and now, and a lot of the same problems were back then and now.
Right, so for anybody who's listening along, it's February of 2024 when we're recording this. SAG-AFTRA and WGA struck from about July until the fall in order to try and get some, workers' rights out of the producers. Streaming has definitely affected the TV and film industry. Writers aren't making the same amount of money that they were making on TV shows writing for streaming scripts, which seems silly because, some of these programs that are on Netflix and Hulu and whatever go viral. And then there was the whole concept of AI and how they were going to, scan actors and pay them for the day that they scan them, but not pay them when their appearance was in a TV show.
Oh, also with AI too, their voiceovers. And they would record their voices and have enough snippets that they could actually use those voices to create a whole new that actor's voice doing a script that they never ever recorded.
So that brings up the whole, what, like AI does have a role. Like, I think it was interesting that they allowed or that they were able to help Heath Ledger posthumously finish his role in Batman when he passed away unexpectedly. I think it was useful there. I definitely feel like that's a rider you could put in any actor's contract. It's just, like I can't imagine if they did that to like any of the deceased actors who they want to bring back into movies because, like look at how the death of the Black Panther, Chadwick Boseman, changed probably the script and the film industry, or not the film industry,
The
changed the
film
script and the
itself.
films itself following the sequels because they no longer had the talent that they used to create the concept. So, and his death was also tragic. So I don't know.
Well, also too, there's another a part that I wanted to bring in here. I mean, you we're talking about the actors and all of that, but music has been doing similar things like this for years. Hank Williams Senior and Junior, when they brought him and he was singing his dad's song, and they superimposed his dad to where they did a duet. Nat King Cole and his daughter. Those were tributes,
But those are
but
both their children too, so they have the rights.
they do have the rights, but this is something that was groundbreaking as a tribute back then that is now like, oh, let's expand on that concept.
And all wait, didn't they take Selena's audio, like the she was a Mexican artist who was, killed by a fan. And they took some of her raw audio and released a new CD recently or a new album because they were able to get techniques. So I don't want to say it's totally wrong, but I also feel like, AI needs to have some ethical guidelines that it doesn't currently have, and I don't want to see people lose meaningful work to an industry that is, known to be somewhat predatory.
Well, also in the same respect with AI, though, and giving credibility, if you're taking away from the actors and using AI instead, you're going to be sacrificing the wonderful creativity that would be coming out. AI cannot be as creative, I feel, as the human imagination.
Or just facial expressions are really unique to every individual, and I don't know that they can really like capture someone's facial expressions in a relevant way on one AI scan.
Well, that's the thing, is they're going to be doing multiple AI scans and multiple scans of them throughout, because you can do that once you hit film.
Right. What's the terrible thing? There's also the idea that someone would never age. Like, if they capture you as an extra when you're 20, you are 20 for the rest of your life. How long can they possibly use that?
My concern, too, is what happens when they pass away?
Right.
You know, is it now open forum, to where they can continue to use everything? Does their families now get no benefit?
Right. For anybody who doesn't know, we have a toddler in with us. I'm sorry you have opinions. I'm sorry I picked you up. Okay. We could go into more specifics about that, but that's not the whole topic of the podcast. The topic of the podcast is that strikes in the entertainment industry are not new. Specifically, what we're interested in are two historic strikes done by chorus women. One, it was Ziegfeld's Follies in the 20s, and then 1940s, the Apollo dancers went on strike. And so I guess we'll go in a chronological order, but do you want to read the Wikipedia entry
Equity?
Yes.
Absolutely. So the Chorus Equity Association was created on August 12th, 1919 in New York City during the strike by the Actors Equity Association after Ziegfeld revealed that he was joining the Producers Managers Association. The chorus girls in his Ziegfeld Follies created their own union with the help of a substantial donation from the superstar actress and former chorus girl, Lillian Russell. Okay, so that gives us some basic background here.
Right, and so we will probably end up doing an episode on Lillian Russell, but she's not the focus. Now, there's a couple of pictures in that Wikipedia article that I think are super awesome. One is a picture of
Mary Dressler and Ethel Barrymore.
Right, yes, thank you. And they're holding signs in front of a car and looking fancy. Isn't Ethel Barrymore wearing a mink coat or something ridiculous?
I believe yes.
Yeah, okay, so that's very Ethel Barrymore.
They were dressed in their finery, and it says no more pay, fair play.
So they were looking to protect the chorus girls primarily on wages, and
here on the one sign says no more pay, just fair play. Right. They wanted to be able to still run their life, work for whoever they need to work for. It wasn't that they were pushing 100% for more pay. They wanted to have it to where they were not being restricted, because at that time they also had the circles. You know what I'm saying? And for the different groups.
Wait, what do you mean circles for groups? Wheels, not the wheels. You're talking about the people that ran circuits, or?
Yes and yes.
Okay.
So for burlesque, you had the wheel, and they were theaters and all that you could work. Okay. And they would take you, and you couldn't work for them, but you could work for this one. Or you couldn't work, they would blackball you to where you couldn't work.
Okay, so you can't work for this theater if you work for this other theater, but as long as you work for these five theaters, you're going to be fine.
Correct.
Okay. So going back to the Chorus Equity Association, what I did read about some of the Ziegfeld Follies was that they were in a sort of situation where they would find themselves, to make some extra money, right? Because chorus work paid, but it didn't pay so well that you were living in a penthouse apartment. So some of these girls, The theater that they were operating out of, you had space to interact with the patrons. And so some of these dancer people were allowing patrons to like pop the balloons on their dress for extra money, you know? And so that's sort of the exploitative aspect of, you know, like how consensual was that? How desperate are you for money if you're letting someone destroy the disposable part of your costume for extra pay? And I feel like in 1919, when they went out and they said to, you know, Ziegfeld, we need X wages. Remember the number of people that he was auditioning, right?
Oh, absolutely.
He could have totally replaced that chorus line. I think it's very interesting that the Actors' Equity Association, which is more for theater performers or theater actors than SAG-AFTRA is, supported the chorus dancers.
Right.
And that they formed, you know, like helped them form. And I also think that it's important that alumni participated. And I just want to drop the name Ethel Barrymore one more time, because when we get to how it affects today in the wrap-up.
So another piece of information I wanted to throw in here, which I thought was really interesting. Mary Dressler, another former famous chorus girl who has gone to the major stage, she was elected the association's first president. And she led them to join the strike, and they marched down Broadway in solidarity with the Actors' Equity Association. And they then merged with them, where the Chorus Equity Association and the Actors' Equity Association merged in 1955.
Yeah.
So back in 1919, they still, together with the chorus, they came together and said, yes, we are all performers, you know?
I know. Where's my Disney song about, like, we're marching arm in arm as women on strike? Like, that kind of goes with Sister Suffragette from Mary Poppins. So then the other sort of chorus strike that I think is memorable and why I'm like rushing to get this episode out for Black History Month is the Apollo dancers going on strike.
Absolutely.
And so the thing that I think is so cool about that is that...
Was that 1940s?
It was in the 40s. Give me one second. I have the specifics. Somewhere, if I'm not foolish. Here we go. So, nope. So in 1934, the Apollo Theater opened, right? And at that point, it's featuring Cab Calloway, Duke Ellington, Jimmy Lunceford, Pink Feet, Markham, Butterbeans and Susie, the Ink Spots. And it has, from the start, a chorus line of 16 of the most beautiful dancers in New York who happen to be African American. Over the stage door sign was painted, through these portals past the most beautiful girls in Harlem. So they didn't all necessarily come from Harlem. They weren't all Harlemites, but they were
performers in Harlem.
And they were beautiful, and they were, you know, like these are always good-looking people according to whoever chooses them. And these dancers are the glue that holds the show together. While the headliners come and go, the chorus line rehearses the new show each week, working 15-hour days, 7 days every week. You cannot take the... I need this to be in here, Oliver. I need this to be in here. You can't take it out, okay? I'm going to have to stand here and hold this. So they're working... So let me just rephrase this, because the baby may have unplugged something. They're working 15-hour days, 7 days a week, and the show goes up at 11 a.m., and then when the curtain comes down at night, they're rehearsing for another 2 or 3 hours, preparing for the new show, sometimes until 2 a.m. So they're hardly, like, leaving that theater. They're basically there 15 hours a day, 7 days a week. No vacations, no sick days, and if you weren't there, you lost your job. And that's until February 23rd, 1940. And what happens is that the chorus dancers led the historic first strike by African-American performers on a snowy Saturday night. Instead of taking places at the curtain call, the Apollos... Oh, my gosh. I love you. Here you go. So instead of taking place at curtain call, they decide that they're going to pull out their signs and form a picket line. And the reason that strike was so successful so quickly is because every other act that night, doesn't matter who the headliner was, doesn't matter how important they were, every other act noticed the chorus girls were gone and walked out with them.
awesome. There was total solidarity in that theater. Everyone in that theater supported the Chorus Girls.
Yes.
And I think it's important. I think at that point, it wasn't under African-American ownership. It was owned by someone else. It was Frank Schiffman. So Frank Schiffman settled. So essentially what happens is the other entertainers follow them out the door. The girls won, and the American Guild of Variety Artists was successfully established. So they also established a union. But the American Guild of Variety Artists covers not just dancers, it covers acrobats, it covers vaudevillians, it covers anybody who, or it would have covered anybody who was on the TOBA circuit. And I need to figure out exactly when the TOBA circuit was totally gone, because in some of my research, like, I found out that the last Snake Oil show was in, like, the 60s.
No, actually, I believe it closed in 1972.
Oh, right. Okay, so it's even in the 70s. So it's, you know, like, so if that was going on that long, because if you think about that, that was a show.
Yep.
Then how long were other small things going on? Like, finding an exact end to things is always actually more difficult than figuring out when something started. But the strike lasted one day. Frank Schiffman settled with the union. The dancers' pay was raised by $5 a week.
Which was a lot of money at that time.
Yes.
Because a lot of the other problem with the chorus lines, they got paid last. And sometimes the show would close and they would wait for their money. And if you listen to one of the other podcasts we done, is there was a chorus girl that had wrote home to mom and said, I have $10 to last the month.
Right. So they also got an extra $5 for solo work, and their rehearsal time was limited to 14 hours a week. So they got some extra time back. And the signs from this are kind of some of my favorite, because support Apollo performers. Do not patronize the Apollo Theater. All we ask is a fair day's pay. And then support the American Guild Variety Artists. Don't patronize the Apollo Theater. Unfair pay. And here are these women outdoors looking beautiful. And the New York Amsterdam News covers Apollo Girls Win Strike and goes into some more detail. And it's kind of like uplifting that artists stood together in the past. And it was uplifting, I think, this past time when SAG-AFTRA and WGA were on strike together, you know, pushing against the producers, trying to equalize pay.
Isn't that interesting that in 1919 they were striking and their fear was of the producers?
Yeah.
And the Producers Association.
Yep.
And now here we are, almost 100 years later.
Producers Association.
Again.
I know. Everything's old. History repeats itself. Everything that's old is new again.
Yep.
And then my final thought on this, and you and I have very different takes on this.
Oh, we do. We do.
Yeah. So here's Drew Barrymore, who has... She's sort of like breaking the line of solidarity among actors and other artists in the industry, because I don't know if you remember, but during the fall, her talk show is supposed to come back. Now, Ethel Barrymore is her great-grandmother or her grandmother? Her great-grandmother.
I believe it's a great-grandmother.
Yeah. And so in her family tree is someone who, you know, had solidarity with striking workers, and yet she was absolutely ready to go back to work, and there was backlash, very public, like a public outcry, because she was ready to go back to work.
Because Drew Barrymore was ready to go back to work.
And run her talk show. And I think she has WGA writers on staff, but she was going to hire scabs, and she was going to go back to work. And I have very mixed feelings about this, because I have always loved, you know, like, I grew up with her, right? I grew up watching her. She's in, like, the movies that were my favorite in childhood. You know, like, who doesn't love E.T. and who doesn't love Ever After?
Yeah.
Right?
Mm-hmm.
And yet, Drew is also like this. Also, the Santa Clarita Diet is like awesome if you haven't watched it. I thought that was so funny. But yeah, she's. I feel like she should have stuck to the team and waited and just held off. So I'm wondering what her internal pressures were that she was ready to go back to work.
Well, there was more people in her. Here's my feelings, okay? There's more people that rely on her talk show than just those that are part of that union that that was on strike, that rely on her paycheck. So, you know, maybe that was part of her thought, is there are other people that will suffer if I don't reopen or restart, you know, go back to work.
Yeah, I gotta look and see who the camera, what union the camera people. She has kids. Like, I absolutely know she has kids. And I also know, you know, she is fighting what I think is the worst part of Hollywood, which is that you can be Sean Connery and you can be any age, but you can't be there. Where are the parts for like Helen Mirren? Mm. You know, she's consistently working in a great way, but there's 10 Sean Connerys and one Helen Mirren.
Yeah.
And that is something that I think plagues every female in the entertainment industry, because, you know, like chorus women feel like, you know, they have an expiration date. Like Dita Von Teese kept saying that she was going to retire at like 40, and then she hit 40 and she kept going. And I mean, I'm not complaining. I think somebody needs to keep going after 40. But I also think it's really keen that she thought she had an expiration date.
Do you all think of it have an expiration date? For those of you who don't know, I spent 25 years as a belly dancer and still dance to this day. But yes, even in that, you know right up front, by 35, you have an expiration date. No, and once I hit 35, I ended up having a harder time getting hired locally. And believe the audience wants to see what they believe the audience will pay for.
Right.
Is a woman under the age of 40 or under a certain look. And also your body gives out. I mean, when you're doing a chorus line and you're rehearsing 15 hours a day, your body gives up.
Yeah.
You know, you're going to be injured. And that was the biggest fear, is being injured and not being able to work at all.
Right.
I mean, there were many dancers, even including myself, went to work and did a show with a broken foot or broken bones.
Or an upset shoulder. Yeah. So I don't know how much that played into her decision, and I don't want to, you know, jump into her mindset and make speculations. Isn't it cool when your toddler decides to participate in your podcast?
Well, at least he's singing. He's definitely starting with theater.
Yeah. Yeah, true. At any rate, I think we're wrapping this episode up. And I'm going to try and get it up as soon as possible, because I would like it to be up for some part of Black History Month to honor the Apollo Chorus Girls and their contribution to performer solidarity.
Absolutely. Absolutely. And I think that they really hit the nail on the head in order for that to be closed and get with everything that they wanted, you know, in a day.